Hey, kids.
You're listening to the internet's wettest podcast about video games, consoles,
and pancakes.
The SML Podcast.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Chris is here. Pernell's here. Big Adam's here. How's everyone doing?
What up?
Sleepy, but good. Had a good day.
Very good, but sleepy.
That's right. It's a good way to be, because once I'm done the show, it means I'm going right to sleep. No need to fidget in bed. Just pass the fuck out.
That's a good idea. That's a very good idea.
I'm probably going to continue playing my game until I pass out. I had a post do pretty well on Blue Sky today. If you want to, I say tell pretty well, it's like 15 likes, but you know, only two of them are from people I follow. Those are good Blue Sky numbers. Okay.
Those
are pretty good. Anyway, I said, so the game I'm playing is Dragon Quest IX. If you remember, that's the DS specific one that had...
That thing was fantastic. With the
It had local wireless multiplayer and, you know, DLC and, maps, lots of maps. Very unique entry in the main line. A lot of stuff they never revisited, but, the thing I said about it, after... 200 hours of playing it, Dragon Quest IX is fantastic because at its core it's a dress-up doll game, but to get the clothes, etc., you have to grind in a bunch of maps for 700 hours.
So that is accurate.
Yeah,
so I feel like with me, I had my little character loadout and never changed anybody again. I just had I remember having a berserker, and the berserker was just stupid powerful.
You could just change the jobs and go for something else with the same characters, and it can feed into the overall quality of the character in its original job. So, it's totally a valid strategy to never have to swap out party members. Just, you know, pick three, you know, pick the three that they give you, or, you know, make up three and just load out that way. That's how I do it.
I had a Reddit post do pretty well this week.
Nice.
My wife posted a picture of her odometer that was 111111. And someone commented, "How long were you waiting for it to hit that?" And she replied, 111110 miles. 8,800 points on Reddit. That's like the second highest thing I've ever had on there.
Oh, wow. That's not bad.
And then I had a comment. Someone's asking about bands that sold out.
Okay.
Completely changed their sound once they got popular. And I'm like, Sugar Ray.
Yeah.
That's my prime example.
That's a really interesting one. If you listen to Mark McGrath in interviews and stuff, he's a interesting guy. However you feel about Sugar Ray, I mean, it's fine. But, you're definitely, they're divisive for sure. So,
I mean, you're entitled to your albums were new metal, heavy.
Oh, I know. I've heard them.
And then Fly came out, and they're like, every morning.
Yeah, it's, and the way he tells that story is, it's interesting the way that kind of came out. It wasn't, it was kind of a sellout move, but just, I don't know, the circumstances around it. Because you think selling out's this super easy thing that all bands can do. Trust me, you can't do it just on purpose. I've tried. But, when it does happen, it's usually a pretty interesting story because there's actually a lot of parts that go into it, like moving parts and right place, right time type of stuff, like any fame story. But it's just interesting when you are looking at something that is very superficial and you find out there's actually kind of this there's still this whole thing with it, it's. Yeah, I don't know. When you find out there's more to think about it than just the basic thought of selling out to something, that's what I can say on that.
Adam, how's your week been?
Very busy. Work's been crazy.
So I've had a lot going on with work. Wasn't feeling super hot yesterday, but luckily that has passed. But I'm very much looking forward to this weekend now.
Oh?
So, yes, Saturday. Saturday we have second row tickets to a GCW wrestling show.
That is fucking awesome.
Very fun.
Pretty.
Where is it at?
It's in Joppa, Maryland.
Oh, I have no idea wrestling that close up here.
Northeast Baltimore County-ish.
Get tickets, Purnell. Go. Go watch wrestling. Meet up with Big Adam.
That would not be a bad idea, except then I have to figure out what to do with the other days I got planned this weekend. It's very sudden, like, oh!
I mean, a month of the day. I learned that I was going yesterday, so.
That's awesome.
How that was, so did someone hook you up with a ticket, or it was like the event? Because like when wrestling happens, Adam's there.
No.
So
no, that's not it. It's just like, that's the thing, like, dude, my life is so weird. I just, things happen. And I'm presented in life with opportunities, and I take them.
Not related to wrestling, but related to the last minute thing. That's actually something that happened to me recently. I played a show with my band, and then later that night, the drummer invited me to see one of my all-time favorite bands that had broken up over 20 years ago that were playing that night because they got back together for a tour. And I was like, yeah, the band Soul Coughing, if you remember them.
Oh.
I remember them.
Yeah.
Well, they're Soul Wheezing.
Nice. They're one of my favorites from, you know, there's one of the, I would say, quirky white people music bands of the 90s. One of the better ones. But yeah, I never thought I would see them live. They broke up right after I got into them. And then I just, after playing a show, like that night, got to go just because somebody was nice enough to buy an extra ticket and then see if they could find a second Soul Coughing fan in town. And I just happened to be there. We were both shocked.
I think the only song I know from Soul Coughing is their song on the Spawn soundtrack.
You'll have to let me know what the title is because I don't know the Spawn soundtrack.
A plane scraped its belly on a sooty yellow moon.
That's probably written specifically for that because that's not on any of their albums, but yeah, that's a good title.
The whole Spawn soundtrack is collaborations. Like, the Spawn soundtrack is one of my all-time favorite movie soundtracks. Like, Filter and the Crystal Method, Marilyn Manson Very and cool. the Sneaker Pimps, Korn and the Dust Brothers, Butthole Surfers and Moby, Metallica and DJ Spooky, Soul Coughing and Roni Size.
Oh, okay.
Incubus,
I don't know Roni
DJ
Size.
DJ Greyboy. Like, the Spawn soundtrack really is fucking good.
Nice. The only video game tie-in I can think of them, I know that's not a video game. Well, Spawn is a video game, but I know that's not what you're talking about. But the one that I can think of is they were in the soundtrack to Final Fight Streetwise, the really terrible PlayStation 2 Xbox era 3D Jeez. Reimagining of Final Fight. Which I do remember because I heard a Soul Coughing song in it.
That's cool.
Yeah. It's not a good game though, folks. Don't seek it out.
That was not a
that
good one.
That just makes
one.
You want to seek it out more.
I mean, yeah, bad game fans definitely go seek it out, but you know, the rest of everyone, yeah, don't it's not Run, buried treasure. Walk. Don't go looking for it.
Anyway. It should be buried, but it's no treasure.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect.
Oh man. Oh. So Adam, this wrestling going on this weekend, who are you excited to see the most?
Live, probably Effie, just because I've never seen Effie before live. Joey Janela is always cool to see live. Always have a good time.
He's a psycho.
He is. He's a nut job. And I'm very, very much looking forward to hearing Matt scream at Manders about getting a new, less dumb name.
I will be so mad if he doesn't yell at Manders to change his name.
I don't think you understand Matt, because
this dude's wrestling name is literally the number one called Manders. That's his name. One called Manders.
He wants you to know.
What the hell kind of name is that?
I hope Matt yells at him.
It's his name.
I still think Matt's the reason Bobby Fish got let go out of AEW.
Matt's going to see Manders and be like,
I need you to fuck off, sir.
I mean, essentially. Yeah.
Respectfully.
Respectfully.
Manders.
Has a whole different meaning in our circle.
Oh, it sure does, which made that an interesting situation for a moment. I was like, I don't think he knows what he's saying right now.
Who, me?
Yeah.
No, I don't.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And that's fine.
Yeah.
I say respectfully a lot. It's just in
so do context.
So do we.
Right.
Anytime there's a women's match, like, we are so full of respect.
Oh, yeah, no, I get that. Yeah, no, that's also, that's in other circles, too. That's, I think I know what you're saying.
A heavy amount of respect.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, should we talk reviews? We got a handful. I know everyone's tired. Should we blaze through these?
Okay, I just want to say that I love that the first couple of titles, like, really sound like the kind of games that you would talk about if you're at your tiredest. Anyway, just looking at the list. Heck, my game like too, the actually. The way you have it written.
Answer.
The way you have my name, I know that this isn't the title of my game, but the one that you wrote down is just artwork too. and I just love that. I don't know.
Only the most artwork will do.
You guys heard artwork
on this episode.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry. I keep derailing because I'm drinking caffeine now. So please just
so am I.
Bulldoze over what? Nice. I like those. So please just bulldoze over what I'm saying and proceed.
All right, Adam, you ready?
Sure.
Knock this out and go to sleep.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do.
All right, first game to talk about tonight is World of Goo 2, developed and published by 2D Boy and Tomorrow Corporation, released April 25th, PS5 and PC for $29.99, iOS and Android for $9.99, previously available on the Switch. Build bridges, grow towers, terraform terrain, and fuel flying machines in the stunning follow-up to the multi-award-winning World of Goo. The world is beautiful, dangerous, and evolving. Adam, what is World of Goo 2?
Goo 2.
Electric Boogaloo.
Yeah, right? So, I was actually a huge fan of the first game, the World of Goo game. It actually harkens back to my time in the game development industry, because that's when I got my hands on it. I believe that's when the first game came out. I've put a lot of time into that because it was a physics-based puzzle game, and the physics were actually pretty good. And at that time, they weren't super common. There was stuff like World of Goo and stuff like Crayon Physics Deluxe, if you remember games like that. But they weren't super common. Anymore, obviously, the landscape has changed, and that's not quite the case anymore. But World of Goo 2 really did take me back to that time period. And still, as I'm going to be working through it, because I do intend on finishing this one, really harkens back to a really fun time in puzzle games, when puzzle games were still kind of easy to figure out, but hard to master. It's like that the motto for that game, Othello, a moment to learn, a lifetime to master. Because you can get through the levels in a game like this, but in order to, you know, get the kudos that you would want and or deserve, you have to achieve three different, like, goals for each of the spots on each one of the maps. Backing up a little bit, because I got a little zeroed in there, World of Goo 2 actually takes place many years after the first game. At the end of the first game, basically all of the it's thought that all of the natural goo has been sucked up by the goo company or corporation. It was used in this big tower. At the end of the game, you find out that the goos actually are not extinct because they're dead. They escape the tower and they go off to their goo planet, and everything's hunky-dory. Happy ending. Well, World of Goo 2, like I said, takes place many years later. And after some, I believe it starts with some just seismic activity, where some goose starts to come back out. And the game just kind of starts you off with a simple puzzle to introduce the concept of the game, which is to get as many goo balls into the little vacuum tube that you can in the quickest amount of time, in the least amount of moves, and getting the most amount of goo balls in there, which is kind of goes hand in hand with the least amount of use, the least amount of moves, because every time you use a goo ball, it becomes part of your structure. And then once you've gotten to the pipe, it's going to suck up any of the goo balls that you haven't really incorporated into your structure to get to that pipe. And that's how the end of the round is scored there. And some of the challenges that you have to overcome because of the way the physics are incorporated into this game are nuts. Because you can start just like you have to build, you know, at 15 meters vertical. But if you're leaning too far to the right, the tower will absolutely wobble in that direction, because while it's rigid, the further away you use the little goo balls to build your structure, the weaker that support is. So when you're gaining distance, you're losing rigidity. So there's like a fine line that you kind of have to balance there. This game also introduces a couple new aspects to get the goo balls going to their final destination. I've only gotten through the first two chapters thus far, but already there are these goo cannons that shoot the goo, or it's just the goo. It's just whatever scenario you're in. And you can actually aim the cannon and the way that the arc of the goo is going to go by clicking on it and dragging the little alive cannon's tongue out. And it acts like a trajectory arc. It's pretty cool. It's pretty awesome. There's also these clear goo balls that act as like a tubing system, or a conduit, I believe is what they're called in the game. And you can suck up goo that is not in goo balls to collect the goo. It turns the clear ones into goo balls. And then they've done so much with this game that I didn't actually expect. I just figured that this was going to be a physics puzzle building game, get to point A, get to point B, but they really actually put some flesh into this game, which is awesome. And that doesn't even mention the new way that they deliver the storylines. The animations are so much cleaner. They're so much better. The sign work in the game to instruct the player of not only the storyline of what's going on, but the missions, what to do if you get lost, how to get unlost. They really did a service to allow just about anybody to enjoy this game, good at puzzle games or not. I've only found myself getting stuck a couple of times on maps, and it was just because I wasn't thinking all the way through before I started, making moves. It's easy to get ahead of yourself in puzzle games, and I tend to do that to myself. But that being said, like I said, this game is very good at putting you back on track if you fall off track. The going back to the storyline, the first chapter is all about how not only the seismic activity bringing the goo back, but you also come to find out that the World of Goo Corporation is now known as the World of Goo organization, and it's like a parody on mega companies that are known to like pollute the universe, who do like green initiatives and say that, like, we're reducing our carbon footprint and that kind of thing. Like, it's a total parody of that. Instead of like in the commercial for the goo thing, instead of the pipe going up, it's a big leaf or like a vine with a leaf at the end. And then once the commercial goes off of the big screen, everybody's like, let's go shopping like good consumers. And they all scurry off throwing their trash everywhere. Like it's a play on consumerism, obviously. Like that's the message behind it. But it's got an insanely cartoony story to it. Coming to the end of the first like level, which is, I believe it's called the Very Long Road or the Very Windy Road, something like that. You basically find out that there is a giant creature that is the landmass that you're on. And like all of the goo balls are currently living on its back, like all of the goo balls that it controls. And like it's like breathing fire, and it's just nuts. There's just way more. I couldn't actually get over how much in-depth story goes into this, because when you get through the first level, you go into the second level, and it's literally the factory from the first one repurposed into a satellite station, which is awesome. I would have never expected a goo puzzle game to have an in-depth story. Even when Joe was like, hey, do you want to review this? I was like, that's cool. It'll be a fun little puzzle game that I can play for a little bit. And then I actually got sucked into the storyline. Like a storyline of a puzzle game. That's weird to me. I've never had that necessarily happen outside of something, let's say, Portal. You know what I mean? But yeah, I mean, I kind of rambled a bit there, because I'm very tired. But this game is a lot of fun. It's challenging in the right ways, but it's forgiving in the ways that you allow you to continue to have fun without hitting your head against a brick wall. A lot of puzzle games out there, if you can't figure out the puzzle, you're just cooked, and that's how it works. You figure out the puzzle to move on to the next thing. This is a good bit more, like I said, forgiving, because the barrier to the next stage, so you can continue on the story, isn't necessarily terribly hard. But there are those three flags that you can earn on each and every puzzle if you want to push for, you know, greatness, if you want to be a achievement hunter, if you want to be the person that earns all the trophies, that challenge is there for you. You don't even have to change modes or difficulties or anything like that. It's just the way they set it up is pretty cool. The people that want to see the story and kind of, you know, get lost in the cartoon world, kind of like I did, can do that. Without, again, beating their self there again, without it feeling they're beating their head against a brick wall. But you do have that element of challenge. Oh, well, I'm getting, you know, all three flags on every single level. And if you can do that, more power to you, because I do not have that capability. Very, very fun game. If you like puzzle games, check this out. If you liked World of Goo 1, or you had World of Goo 1 long time ago when that game came out, over a decade ago, this is a must-have. Especially if this game is, you said it's $30 retail, yep, right now?
Yep, $30 on PS5 and PC, $10 on mobile.
It's
Or Acolyte wants to know, is it good?
Yes, it is good. Very, very good. Yeah, I would say this one gets two thumbs up. I'm definitely going to keep working on it. Like I said, work's been a little crazy, so personally, I haven't had much free time. But the free time that I have been able to spend with this game has been fantastic, and I do intend on completing it.
All right, sounds good. So $30, your official verdict is?
Buy it if you enjoy puzzle games at all. Like, if you enjoy puzzle games at all, this is a great buy. Absolutely go pick this up.
Awesome. All right. Well, Adam, we will let you get to sleep. Thank you, as always, for joining us and hanging out with us. Do you have any final words before we let you go nap?
If the devs are listening, I'm sorry for being a space cadet while giving this. I may or may not be involved in intoxicating scenarios right now, but that's standard edition for this show. You know, stoned is all get out, but that's fine. And go buy World of Goo too, to those that aren't developers, because obviously they get free keys. They made it. And everybody should, you know, get some sleep and be awesome.
Awesome.
Hell yeah. Have a good night.
Later, y'all.
Later, Adam.
Catch you later.
That's his chivalry war cry.
Was that in real time, or was that a sample?
No, that's a sound clip.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's really good.
Word.
Fill that fucker with beans!
All right, let's move on. Next game to talk about, the Slormancer, developed by Slormite Studios, published by Slormite Studios and Abiding Bridge. Released May 13th out of Steam Early Access for $19.99. Fight hordes of enemies led by the Slormancer, an evil warlock from the past, in an absurd yet epic action RPG. Experience fast-paced gameplay, loads of shiny loot, tons of collectibles, countless hours of content, and carefully crafted pixel art. Brunel, what is the Slormancer?
So the Slormancer is an action RPG. Yeah, that. The Slormancer is an action RPG where you can play as one of three unique classes of characters who are pretty much filling in for the hero of the realm, who gets his ass handed to him at the very beginning of the game by a protein drink, resulting in his death and him then becoming sort of a guardian spirit for you as you traverse the lands to defeat the Slormancer himself and saving the day. The three characters that you can control end up being going between three classes: a huntress, who uses a bow and arrow as their primary weapon, a knight, who uses a sword as their primary weapon, and a mage, who uses the staff as their primary weapon. If you've played something like, say, Diablo 2, maybe Diablo 3 in some respects, then you have a general idea of how the mechanics in this game function. And I'm not saying that as a bad thing, I'm saying as an endearing thing, but it also lets you know what you're in for. Every level in this game consists of you going to fulfill a mission off of a map that you can choose from based on, you know, what levels you have access to. Those levels can either be story related missions, which have, you know, require you to beat them in order to progress the game, or there can be little side levels too, which could come with their own rewards, but sometimes also with their own conditions as well. Now, when you choose a character, they have their own particular quirks associated with them. For example, my favorite character's quirk is the Huntress. Her quirk is she's extremely happy-go-lucky, so much so that when you walk around on the screen, she skips, which made me smile because I could always use a little bit more brightness in my games that I am playing, which is also another point this game has for it, which is that it's very humorous and entertaining in that manner. But her primary quirk is that her temperament is always on display for the game. The happier she is, the faster her skills cool down, and she gets a little bit more of a damage boost for each attack. And the angrier she is, the closer she gets that I noticed to be able to fulfill, get the most out of certain skills that she has equipped. Aside from that, I didn't do a ton with that aspect of it because I was like, okay, well, I like the idea of having the cooldown and being able to, I don't know, use this ability that lets me drop daggers daggers out of the sky when I use a specific other effect. But this is a balancing act because the way those of, you know, her mood is adjusted is by using the same skill in sequence versus alternating skills in sequence. Because when you alternate skills, she becomes happier. When you use the same skill over and over again, she gets frustrated and bored. So, fun fact with that. So, it plays into that. then the mage has a specific quirk where every time he casts a spell, the spell comes of a specific type, which alters a specific ring that he has, which determines other added perks to his skills that he when he uses them. And the knight's a melee jerk. And from what I noticed about him, he has a fair bit of skills related to buffs and perks when he actually activates them. Though I do like that his ranged attack that you mainly, the first one you get from is a wooden twig, which can throw and do more damage than the actual sword you're swinging. It's just weird and funny in that way. As you play through a level, you'll see all kinds of monsters that are attacking you, and you have access to a primary skill by default, but as you level up, you'll gain access to other skills, which can be rotated in as your secondary skill, or even can be used to replace your initial primary skill, should you so choose. One thing I wish this game offered, though, is just the fact that I know there's like other options you get for equipables, but I wish I could use more of my basic attacks at one given time, because that's just... I want to use more attacks and not have to switch them over and over again, but especially because each of those skills level up too. But you basically switch between your primary and secondary skills, and eventually you'll unlock specialization, which allows you to choose one of three, I guess, class-esque ability structures for your character, which determines pretty much their play structure and how to best utilize them. So, for example, in regards to the Huntress that I like so much, if you're a big fan of being happy, you'd want to use the Mistwalker, because a lot of her perks involve her being happy all the time. And if you like being angry all the freaking time, you could be the Sharpshooter, because that primarily focuses on her being angry all the time. And again, all those things have their own particular quirks, and they can all be advanced through way of spending Slorm, which is the game's currency, to level them up. You can basically bump up the perks to increase your stats in regards to them. Sometimes you can get abilities that will augment the individual effects and abilities that you earn as you level up. Abilities, yeah, because in addition to the specializing that I mentioned earlier, as you level up in this game, you will unlock the additional primary skills that you can then equip. But then the more you use the actual attack, you'll unlock the ability to also unlock perks for that specific attack, whether it might be something that lets you unleash a rain of arrow death quicker than before. Or like I mentioned earlier, sometimes you might be able to unleash those arrows and then occasionally have a trap fall out of the sky on top of the arrows themselves. If you find a skill that you like a lot, you should use it a lot, because that will unlock more perks for that skill to become even better. But of course, the game is varieties and spice of life, so you should rotate a lot to eventually see what is the best thing that you can gain with the abilities you have. You can level up your character by leveling, like by killing things. You can level up your skills by spending Slorm on those. You can spend Slorm to purchase items at a store. There's tons of loot you find on the ground, which can be equipped to give your character decked out stats and perks. And your weapon also levels up. As you get new weapons, you get the ability to level them up by using them, which makes them stronger too. That is to say, this game is a lot of grinding, beating things up, leveling up, and then doing it again. And some people will say that as being a negative, and some of those people would be right. But then there's other people who play Diablo, and that's pretty much what Diablo is. Beating crap up, getting better gear, getting, you know, better skills, and doing it all over again until ad nauseum. And this game does that very well, too, I think. The environments are pretty much, you know, they I don't want to call them randomized, but they sure as heck feel like it at times. But again, I don't care. Diablo's environments were generally randomized too, and I didn't notice it so much in those games because I just wanted to kill more things and get higher stats. It also helps that the humor in this game is very much on point. I like the fact that characters are never serious in this game. None of the incidents are very serious. And I'm the type of guy where when I'm playing a title, especially in the moments where I'm extremely exhausted, which is all the time because I'm old, it is humor that keeps me going. A lot of times a humorous game will wake me up more so than a typical grimdark serious game will. That'll put me to sleep. So kudos to the writers of this game for keeping me laughing as I played through it. Overall, I can't really think of any negatives that I even have for the game. The menu system is pretty slick. I appreciate it. At one point, I remember thinking I was going to be unhappy with the text size being so small, but you can adjust that in the settings screen, so I can knock that. Like I said, I just wished I could equip different skills under this primary secondary skills as opposed to having to switch between those, but maybe that's intentional so that you can focus more on the other skills you get later in the game. But with that said, those were my main general gripes for the title. And I also will say, even though I preferred the Huntress, I think every character in the game is generally fun in their own way. So I don't see there being a moment where I'd like, oh God, or let me try, I don't say I'll foresee it. I never saw a moment where the game was like, okay, you have to use the knight for this level. And I go, oh God, not the freaking knight. He sucks. Never happened. So I like all the characters. They all play in their own unique way, but I got to admit I have my favorites. So be it. And yes, right. So ultimately, I do believe the Slormancer is a good chance, a good time to play. Oh, the other complaint I had that was not a real complaint because I found it in the settings. At one point, I was upset that the game auto-aimed as I did dual sticking, but there is actually a setting that you should likely utilize where you can set it to semi-auto or non-auto at all. So if you want to be in full control of the twin stick aiming, knock yourself out. And also maybe switch the primary secondary skills to the triggers or bumpers if you're playing on the Steam Deck or controller like me, because having them as the A and B buttons when you're also using the thumbstick to aim your weapon, maybe not so great. But back to what I was saying before, I do think this game is a good time, and it does come recommended by me, but I should also do the thing that you do with the official verdict.
Yeah, it's a $20 game. If you buy it in the next week or so, it's $14.99. So jump in early and you could save 25%. But at $20, what's your official verdict?
I think it's a buy. I enjoyed my time with it. And I feel like if you're a fan of Diablo, of the more classic style, I think you'll be a fan of it too.
Very good. All right, let's move on. Next game, Vambrace Dungeon Monarch, developed by Dvorak Studio, published by HeadUp. Release May 8th out of Steam Early Access for $14.99. Deck building, dungeon defense, and tactical gameplay combine in Dungeon Monarch. Recruit warriors and wizards, buff your heroes, and thrash your foes. Summon your Dungeon Monarch to punish interlopers and defeat enemies to increase your dark powers. Brunel, what's going on in Vambrace Dungeon Monarch?
So Vambrace Dungeon Monarch is an auto battler deck building tactical, it's a game. So the idea behind this game is you are the Dungeon Monarch. Without going into the full depth narrative of it, you're the Dungeon Monarch trying to prevent heroes from breaching the inner sanctum of your dungeon, thereby disturbing your master's sleep and the entities that dwell within said dungeon. And this is done over the course of a series of rounds, broken up by story segments, in which case you will be tasked with going to bat in the dungeon proper. So what that means is, at the beginning of a round, you'll be faced with the layout of the dungeon. Think of it as a series of paths connected by, or rather phrase that, a series of nodes connected by pathways, leading from the top of the dungeon to the bottom of the dungeon, narrowing out as you get further down. Enemies come in from the top, occupying any one of the spaces that exist at the top of the dungeon. And once they're there, if they are left unimpeded, they will progress deeper into the dungeon. That is bad. Fortunately for you, though, you have armies of the damned, or maybe not so damned. I think they get a bum rap in that case, that are working to stop them from engaging. And the way you work with them is, as the main character, you can spend resources, specifically like the resource that determines how many units are allowed to be on the map at any given time, to place them on the board. However, to start with, though, you might not have any at all. And in order to get more of them, you have to actually go into a submenu which allows you to purchase units from a repository that the game provides to you at that given time. So you might see enemies that take up 3 of your unit resource slots, or it might take up 1 unit resource slot. They all come at a cost. You pay that cost, they go into your reserves. And then once they're in your reserves, you can go back to the battle screen and slot them onto a spot on the board. Every character has their own stats. They have their own special perk, and they have their own, class or family of creature they reside within. The strategy in this game It's surprisingly, you know, layered, considering the fact that it is an auto battler at its core. Depending on what family the monster is in when you place it on the board, there is a counter that you embrace that's on the left side of the screen. And the more of a monster's family type that's in the on the board, the stronger that family is. And they actually get perks that buffs them all up. In addition to that, another element that I'm going to talk more about later in the game, being the cards, are also buffed up sometimes based on if they have a specific perk associated with a family of monster. So once you lend out your monsters and you set them up ready to go, you can also, before the turn is up, spend mana to play cards that are in your hand. Cards come in two forms in this game. They come in basic attacks and whatnot, in which case they affect either one tile, one enemy, a series of tiles, or like a multitude, like the entire dungeon. They cost mana to play, and when you play them, you select the location you want it to affect, and it will do its job. Easy peasy, lemon squeezy. But the other type of card can only be played when your main character, that being you, the Dungeon Monarch, is summoned onto the battlefield. You can choose a spot on the board to summon them to get down and dirty their own with their own bad selves. And when they come down, they generally will have an effect on the entire battlefield as far as like buffs and like fear effects on the monster or the enemies that are encroaching on your dungeon. But then, now that they're down, if you have the mana to do so and you have the cards in your hand, you can spend Monarch exclusive cards that have very powerful effects and are good for pretty much clearing the room, or not, I'm going to rephrase that, clearing the room. Actually, not to the bet. Sometimes they are good for clearing the room. Not a whole freaking floor. That good later in the game. But for clearing general enemies out or entire enemies within one room. And that's a good way to do it, especially if you get a situation where you have your enemy, your character load up, so like you have three or four rooms, and two of those rooms has three units in them, but then unfortunately one room is fairly lacking in your units because you just don't have the slots for them. And then the game decides to be a complete tool bag and spawn the majority of the floor's monsters in the room that you have the lowest defense in. That's a good opportunity to drop the Monarch on their asses and lay the town. I honestly do like that aspect of the game and having that sort of like character nuke that can be placed at any given time, or not any given time, because they do have a cooldown if you send them back, but otherwise any given time. However, you gotta be careful. You don't want the Monarch to take too much damage while they're down. You want them to get in, do their job, and get the hell out. In addition to that, there's also structures you can acquire. Those structures come with a variety of effects that can be used to bolster your defenses too. When you take a structure, you build it somewhere within the dungeon layout, and it affects your dungeon in kind. Sometimes, again, it can affect the floor. Sometimes it can be used for representing monster families to give a better buff and beef up that progression track I was telling you about earlier, and a variety of other effects too. And of course, you can get more cards as you play through the game. Sometimes it's a reward, sometimes at a vendor. And by doing that, you can get to the deck building part of the game where you can swap in and out cards as the situation arises. For example, you might find yourself playing through the game and getting really attached to, you know, Nightstalker monsters. Might be a good opportunity at that point then to, you know, revise your deck a little bit to start making use of Nightstalker cards that can be brought as or earned in packs as rewards. Because that's the other thing about this. When you finish an actual level, in addition to like the rewards you were getting throughout the level itself, you can also get a series of rewards. You might be able to purchase a perk, or not purchase, select a perk, or select a skill, or even a card that can be applied to future sessions. But you also get to choose what I basically describe as a pack of cards. The packs are being broken out based on the different monster families that I mentioned before. So whether or not they are used within that family, if there's like a ratio to them, I don't know. My take based on what I've seen was that if it pertains to that family, if I want more Nightstalker monsters, I'll choose a Nightstalker pack if it's available, and I'll get cards, whether it be perks or monsters associated with, or not perks or monsters, but perks related to Nightstalker creatures. So the one gripe I mainly had about this game as I played it is, I'm on a Steam Deck, mind, so maybe this isn't an issue on the PC, but everything still seems to be primarily built around the keyboard. So despite the fact that I'm on this system, it doesn't have, like, I don't want to call it true controller support, at least from what I can tell. It's more so I'm just having auto binds that I just kind of figured out based on using the mouse on the thumb, the Steam Deck mouse, and then clickers, and then the B button. But otherwise, everything is displayed as keyboard letters still. So, yeah, you can go into the settings if you want to and just kind of make sure you can figure it that way if you so choose. But it would be nice if they just straight up gave it an Xbox controller schema. That way it would just slap right down and be good to go. I mean, I can't imagine being too hard to pull that off. But overall, though, this game pleasantly surprised me. I already like this style of game and this sort of concept of like having, you know, monster, choosing the right monsters for the right situation and having them do what I need to do, like having the right monster. I can say, okay, if he kills monsters in this room, he's going to pursue the next monster over there. He's not going to just sit idle and do nothing. Versus a monster who will feed hit points to fellow monsters in that family just by being on the board and not dead. I like coming up with good synergies like that for auto battlers. Something that I've gotten really into in the last like year or two. So I think this game does a decent job of that.
Cool. Well, it's a $15 game. What are your thoughts on Vambrace Dungeon Monarch?
I think it's a solid try in that regard. And I think it's worth giving a shot to if what I said interests you.
All right. Sounds good.
I know, right? Right?
You would think so.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Next up, Please Touch the Artwork 2, developed and published by Thomas Waterzui, releasing May 23rd on the Switch for $4.99. You're a dandy suit wearing art loving skeleton recently risen from the grave. Yeah, with the ability to travel into and through paintings. Using this ability, you help repair rips in the paintings and find missing items for the people living inside of them. Chris, what is going on in Please Touch the Artwork 2?
Yeah, it's very much something that does what it says on the tin. This is basically So it's like a point-and-click, essentially, like a point-and-click puzzle game, but, you know, it's much simpler than other games in the genre. The biggest draw of it is, yeah, the fact that it utilizes actual works of art. So if you didn't know, James Ensor, Belgium's famous painter, I actually know him because a band I like, They Might Be Giants, wrote a song about him that I've known for like most of my life. Like, I've definitely known the song longer than I've known who James Ensor was. But yeah, it does feature a lot of his artwork. Like I said, he did enjoy like to, you know, make stuff that was like landscapes. There's some surreal stuff, lots of kind of morbid stuff. You know, his self-portrait was of a skeleton, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, there's lots of, it's really cool stuff. But the game does not purport to be a any kind of educational thing. It doesn't, like, if you look in the credits, it credits every single painting and every single piece of music, you know, really it credit where it's due, because yeah, a lot of the you know, besides some animators, coders and such, like Thomas Waterzui is like the main person behind this. But you know, of course, the special thanks and crediting the specific paintworks is like a mile long if you want to look at it. And he credits some of the music to James Ensor. I actually did not know that James Ensor did music as well. So, you know, I've learned something here. And yeah, like the cool thing about it is that, like I said, you're walking around as a skeleton. You know, you just point at somewhere on the screen with the skeleton hand cursor, you know, which you can control, or you can use the touch screen, of course. And, you know, just push on something, he walks there. If you are able to go to the next scene, you push the X button, and that goes to the next scene. And then you kind of walk around at your own pace, of course, until you run into somebody who needs something done. There'll be a character in a painting who will be like, you know, there's no actual dialogue in the game. It'll just be like, the person will kind of like shrug and like he's looking for five sticks or something. And so you go back to the previous scenes and go and find sticks that are in the painting. So, you know, these sticks were not originally in the painting. So they're just kind of like juxtaposed or like kind of laid over like parts of the painting in usually clever ways. And, you know, it gets more and more complicated. For instance, in the second level, which is the city, which is like the first big level, it's a bunch of like cityscapes and things like that. Really, really nice paintings, by the way. But anyways, you run into a lady who is looking for her 20 cats. And I was like, oh, Joe should play this game. And indeed, you walk around and you just, you know, click on the cats and then it adds them to your collection. And once you do that, then another part of the level opens up and then you go and find, you know, somebody's six glasses of whiskey or whatever. And, you know, there's just all kinds of stuff. And like I said, all of it is like derived from actual works of art. It's just it's been animated. And there's actually a kind of cool effect. So there is a zoom in button, which is very, very nice. I'm very glad that they included that. So if you zoom in, you can kind of see that even the paint itself on the art is slightly animated. So everything has a kind of living look to it. You know, it's just kind of it's hard to like describe what it's doing, kind of fluttering, I suppose. But, you know, like I said, it gives the impression that like the art is alive, which is really cool. And so, yeah, as you go through levels, they're, again, very clever because they're all paintings, but they all stitch together. Like when you're in the city, it like it has all of these, you know, different pieces of art that depict different rooms, and they all look like they're kind of connected in the same building. So you can kind of walk between them, even though they're all different paintings from different times. You know, occasionally different artists. You know, it's like it's really cool, like the way it kind of stitches together cohesively. And there's five such levels outside of the prologue. Well, I mean, there's a sixth one that just says the end, and I'm not sure if that's an ending or if that's its own like stage because I haven't gotten there yet. But so on top of like finding the objects, as it were, in the paintings, you're also on the I guess on the tail of a weird criminal of some kind who is using his knife to cut out parts of the paintings and like damage them, and you can like, you know, kind of see the frame underneath and such as he cackles and runs away. Once you have solved enough puzzles that you can access these holes in the paint, you go into another mini game where you basically patch up the painting from the back. Whoa, kitty cat.
Yeah.
You basically do this mini game where you get to patch up the painting from the back. So like the back of the canvas. And those kind of games are like a kind of, you know how you're supposed to like trace, you know, they got those things where you have to like trace a certain shape without, in one continuous stroke without like, you know, going over the same line twice or something like that. It's kind of like that. So there's like a kind of painting repair mini game, as it were. And then also there's another game where that it has you play, which is straight up the highlights for kids, you know, spot the differences in these paintings. and it'll, you know, it changes one painting in a certain way. And when you click on it, then it will circle both the original and the altered version to kind of show you. And those can get kind of complicated, actually. It took me a while to do the first one. Now, if it is taking you too long, there's a very simple but effective hint system. So you could turn hints completely off if you want. That's, you know, if you want to challenge yourself, then totally do that. And then there's two layers to the hint system for if you have them on. One of them is that there will be a, you know, it'll show you what you're looking for, a little icon like the cats, for instance. It'll show a cat at the top of the screen. It'll show the number that you need to get, so like 20, and it counts down from 20. And then it'll show a light bulb. If the light bulb is on, then that means that there is at least one cat in the scene that you are in currently. And once you have cleaned out the room that you're in completely of cats, then it has a little red X that goes over it. It means like, you know, there's no more cats here. And then, you know, you go to the next scene. So you can kind of keep your inventory as far as that goes. You know, you're not just pixel hunting in a certain like square. And some of them actually do really become a pixel hunt because they hide those things really good sometimes. They hid crosses in the city once, and those are really hard to find. If you click on the light bulb and you're like, okay, I actually do want to know where one of these is, it'll briefly circle what you're looking for. So you can just, you know, solve it that way. Just, you know, skip it. And you know, that's totally fine if you're, you know, just kind of getting tired of it and you just want to move on or something, you know. The other thing that I really like about this game is that and this came in real handy again in the second stage, it has a toggle for disturbing noises or distressing noises. So, you know, when you touch like a cat, for instance, then you'll hear a rah! You know, like something like that. That's fine. But there's one room where this guy is, because it's a dinner scene, this guy is just constantly eating. And, you know, of course, you know, some people are very sensitive to that. So if you have the distressing sounds turned off, then you won't hear him eating, but you'll hear everything else. So that's I feel like a lot of games should do things more like that. but yeah, it's mostly, like I said, digging on the music and like I said, it's all like classical music, mostly all piano. Like I said, some of it by James Ensor, but also other composers. There is a there's definitely one song that video game fans will absolutely recognized in a stage because it is a classical song that was more famously repurposed for a very, very popular video game. But yeah, so the God damn it. Okay, anyway, sorry. Wait, 1 minute. Okay, I had to ban somebody from Facebook right quick.
Oh, geez.
An admin's job is never done. Well, yeah, somebody, there's a lot of spam stuff, and sometimes it gets pretty aggressive, so sometimes it's a little bit of an emergency. Anyway, that was basically it. It's just, it's really nice to enjoy these paintings. You know, you won't learn anything about them, you just get to enjoy them and, you know, listen to some tunes and interact with them in a way that obviously you could not in an art gallery or the internet, you know, like finding cats or whatever. So yeah, I like this one. It's nice and relaxing and, like I said, educational in a way. And I love a game where you play as a skeleton.
All right. Well, let's talk about price on this one. On the Switch, it is $5. What do you think?
That's in fuck it, why not territory, of course. But no, I'm going to say this is actually really good quality. You know, it's not a brain teaser. You know, don't go in, you know, with your college learning, thinking that you're going to really bust a muscle on this one. It is just a very cool way to interact with some really interesting artwork. I quite like it as a piece of art itself, you know? And, yeah, I'm just going to say that's a fucking why not. And of course it's really great on Switch because you have the touchscreen interaction with it as well. Although I definitely preferred to play it on the big screen because I like to zoom in and get all the little details and stuff. So, you know, it's up to you. But, yeah, I really like this one. So go ahead and check it out.
Awesome. And if you were on the fence about this one, it is 100% free on Steam.
Oh, there you go. I love that. Where's Waldo meets modern art in this cozy hidden object adventure? I have so many thoughts about that sentence on the Switch sales page. For one, I wonder if James Ensor would come back as a skeleton just to read his work being compared to Where's Waldo. Also, how is Where's Waldo not modern art already, you know?
Nice.
You know what? Yeah, there you go.
Also on Steam, if you decide to pick it up free there, there are 3 donation options that you can purchase to support the dev. They are available in S, M, L.
Whoa.
All medium.
I don't believe it.
Yay. Next game, Cybercore, developed and published by Megami LLC, released to 1.0 April 22nd on Steam for $14.99, released May 13th on Xbox One and Series X and S for $19.99. Brutal, fast-paced, isometric, co-op, loot shooter in a cyberpunk world, equipment-based combos, exotic weapons and armor, easy to start, hard to master, play solo or with friends. Cornell, what's Cybercore?
So Cybercore is pretty much like you describe it, is a top-down looter shooter where you play as a member of Cybercore, kicking ass, taking names, and chewing gum, and being all out of bubble gum and kicking ass, and then, you know, going for the top, but not making it to the top. You know what I'm talking about. All those things combined to form a fun little niche of a game. The game is primarily about the idea of getting cool gear. I guess it's kind of funny. It's almost akin to the last game I played, except this is multiplayer, largely multiplayer if you have the means to do that. You choose from your base from a series of missions. These missions can be either story mission-based or side mission-based. And by engaging those, they generally tell you two things. One, the level of difficulty that the mission should be. And that is represented by a power symbol, basically saying you need to be like this level to ride this bike, which you may not have to be. I've definitely beaten levels where I was below the threshold for that power structure, but it doesn't matter. It's just there for your amusement and, you know, information. The other thing they'll show you is the list of loot that can be potentially acquired within a level. I do know you can spend resources to lock a loot item in if you so see something that you really like and you want to keep. I never did that, which is something I'll bring up later in the review, which is not a bad thing. It's just a Pernell thing. But either way, once you decide to choose a mission, you are on the field kicking, going to business. Default, you have a few abilities. You have a melee weapon, which you can swing by pressing the B button. I'm playing this on the Steam Deck, by the way. And you also have access to a firearm. Firearm can be used by pressing the right trigger button. When you press the right trigger button, you pretty much fire bullets from your gun until it runs out of bullets or you need to reload, which can be reloaded with the X button. It does that thing in games where if you time the button press correctly on the reload, you reload faster. Possibly with a perk, that part I don't know. I just know reloading fast is a good thing, and it could potentially support your combo. So, what that stands for is, once you're down on the ground, the levels are laid out, randomly generated. You are then tasked with getting from point A to point B to fulfill the goal. Sometimes it's like a capture the flag situation, sometimes it's killing a target, sometimes it's holding down the fort for a certain amount of time, sometimes it's finding objects, you know the deal. And enemies will come out in full freaking force. When they come out, you can kill them. They'll be sometimes drop items or currency. But essentially, you want to kill as many enemies as you can when the time comes. Like, at least I do. I don't leave anybody standing, though the game really gives you the ability to do that anyway. Sometimes, while you're exploring these levels, you might come across little secret caches or boxes that contain loot, which you can then, if you so choose, equip it to your character and get stronger that way. Equipment comes in the form of two weapon types, or two firearms, a melee weapon, helmet, legwear, and chestwear. And all these things have their own specific perks. Like, for example, weapons come in a variety of classes, like shotguns, pistols, submachine guns, you name it, it's probably here, but not claws. Why aren't there claws in this game? That would be freaking awesome. The melee weapon is for melee purposes, and it's just pretty much, it has its own various stats. Essentially, there's a lot of intent for comboing in this thing. Different weapons with different perks and different stats that can be combined to suit a specific playing style. There's also skills that you can equip to the game, and skills are acquired by way of playing the game as well. And you get a number of things, like, for example, the game starts you with a flash dash maneuver, which can help you kind of blink through objects so much, so it's actually in the tutorial. But I very quickly swapped it out for an auto turret because, yeah, I like the idea of auto turrets kicking ass when I need them to. So you could pretty much customize your special skills to suit the needs of you if you're playing single player, or the needs of your team if you're playing multiplayer. You might find yourself wanting to put a defensive perk on your character because you want the other guys on your team to do all the melee, do the brawling, so you want them to focus their skills on things that are meant to increase their damage per second. So if you're playing with other people, you lucky bastard, choose the opportunity to synchronize and synergize with your teammates to decide what you want to equip and what you want to do. Once you beat a level, you are given a score based on how well you performed. You go back to the main base. Well, admittedly, if it's a story level, you might get a little bit of social content there. But otherwise, it's back to choosing another mission, getting back into the fray, and doing it all over again, but hopefully with bigger numbers, because that's the name of the game. Bigger numbers. Yeah, baby. But you might hear me talk about this and think, this guy is really down on this game. He's not very enthusiastic about it. Well, no, I'm tired. You heard Big Adam earlier in the episode. We're all tired tonight. But that doesn't make this game bad by any means. It does a specific thing it sets up to do, and it does a good job of doing it. I think it would be suited better if I had other people that I was playing it with, because I feel like that would be a thing that would get me more going. But the way I play games like this, especially in games like this where the loot comes fairly quickly, is that I don't pay a ton of attention to the minor aspects of the weapons. I just look for bigger number and weapon type. So does it do more damage per second? Yes. Is it considered a rare quality weapon? Okay, that puts it up there a little higher. And does the electric bolt a bigger number than my old one? Yes. Well, then I'm probably putting it on. What about the other things? Don't care about the other things. I just care about the type, the power level, and the rarity level. That's it. And armor, I'm just like, is the number bigger? Yes, and I'm putting it on. Yeah, there's likely going to be some fashion aspects going on with this thing, because the armor does come in a variety of different colors, and you can paint it and get it to look just the way you want, and that's there for people who want to engage that. I want bigger numbers, and I'm doing that. So if the game doesn't hit me with a wall before a certain point, you might find me ignoring a lot of the drops I get, even until eventually I'm starting to get my ass kicked by a random, you know, synth agent that just appears out of nowhere and has way more health than anybody I've fought so far. Then maybe it might be time to review my inventory and see if something sticks out that trumps my level 2 gun. Oh, wait, a level 7 gun. Yeah, that's better. But yeah, I think the game is actually pretty fun. I can totally see what they were going for with this title, and I personally think they managed to succeed at getting that. Some people might complain about wanting it to be just a giant open world where they can just explore here and there to their heart's content. But at the same time, there's also something nice to be said about is pick up and play. Choose a level, fulfill the mission, wrap it up, get some new gear, and either do another round or go to bed. I'm choosing to go to bed, but after proclaiming this game to be a decent time.
All right, well, it's $15, $20 on Xbox. What do you think?
I think it's a buy. Or try it by yourself. I think it's definitely a buy with you if you got friends to play multiplayer with you.
Awesome. Sounds good. Next up, Andy Sperry is joining us. Andy, how are you doing?
Hey. Andy. What's up, guys?
Andy.
How you guys doing?
How's it going?
Word.
Where?
All right, on the tired side, but can't complain. It was a good day.
That's what I heard. I heard everybody's tired today, dude. It's my classic SML podcast, dude. Everybody is taking a nap.
We're not that bad. Sometimes we have life in us. Sometimes we're all drinking Red Bulls and partying like 1997.
Yeah, I got caffeine in me. That's not exactly life, but you know, it's a good way to fake it.
It's late for you guys, and I totally understand that too. I'm West Coast time too, so it's a little bit earlier for me, but it's late for you guys, so I totally get the tired feeling for sure.
Oh, you got it good. If you're talking about late, or you're talking about West Coast time.
I'm doing great, man. You know, I mean, I just got back. Sorry, guys, I've been out from the show. I've been coaching soccer, dude. Tuesdays and Thursdays and Saturdays are my days. So,
damn,
I've been away, man. I've been busy, yeah, busy dad, dude. But it's good to be back, dude. At least tonight, you guys started.
Good to have you
late
on.
To have you back. Good to have you back, sir.
Yeah,
indeed. You got a game to talk about. Should we get to it?
Oh, we can. Yeah. If you want to, I didn't know where I was in the list, so I was just kind of hanging
You're
out
right now.
Oh shit. Hell yeah, dude. Let's do it. Let's talk about it, dude.
Next game, Goblin Town, really hard driving game, developed and published by Truth Arts, released April 30th on Steam Early Access for $14.99. Do you have the skill, the moxie, and most importantly, the flaps to be McGoblin Burger's greatestest delivery gob ever? Speed your way through a sadistic gauntlet of hairpin turns, explosions, and other mayhem designed to ruin your fun. And run, and don't forget to scream. Andy, what is Goblin Town?
I mean, that description right there pretty much tells you everything you need to know about the game, so go buy it. I don't even know why you need me here for that, but no, it was really awesome. I contacted Truth Arts and talked to them, and they were very excited to send a couple of codes over, which was, again, huge thank you to them. But let me start off by saying that if you've seen my stream before, Joe, you know, I've got a tab to redeem a game off a list of what I call like the troll games list, right? And those are all games to be overly challenging, screw with me, you know, some sort of way, like Bennett Foddy or Ghouls and Ghosts, Alt F4, you know, a few others that I'm still upset with right now to really mention, but... But this is, I would say, Goblin Town is my first goblin game to add to the list. So I'm very excited to have it in the rotation as well. We did stream it the other day too, which was exciting and frustrating and fun. But let me get into the game itself. The setup is pretty simple. You are basically the new hire at McGoblin Burger. You're the new delivery goblin. And you need to take this juicy, delicious, probably gangrene burger up to the highest peak in Goblin Town in record time. I guess there's not really like a time on it. It keeps track of time, but it's just kind of, you know, McGoblin is all about whenever you make it up to the top, you're good. So you hop in the company's riggedy-ass vehicle, and they tell you, good luck to drive up this crazy road. So the road up to the top is difficult, arduous, really hard, as they describe it. It's not an easy game. It's a winding road with twists and turns, breaks off in some points. It's full of explosive barrels, just random old refrigerators, punching gloves that'll knock you off the track. Giant swinging hammers, and pretty much like certain death on either side of the pathway at all times. Poison gas, there's giant goblin like whales flying around too. So, but it's insane. The layout for this game is absolutely insane. But I'm here for it. I love it. Lucky for you though, it's not all bad barreling through the insanity. You've got a boost meter that refills over time. You can also pick up little boost canisters along the way. The boost bar doubles as a kind of a bunny hop for your vehicle. So if you need to get across a platform or take some kind of daring shortcut, you know, along the route, you can blast towards an edge, dude, fly off and get a couple of jumps in to make it to that next platform. There's also, like I mentioned, the explosives. You're pretty much racing against yourself in this one. So even once you make it to the top, you know, going back through the game again, you know, is always fun trying to see if you can beat your time. So there's little explosive barrels. You can pop off of those and fly off to the next platform. There's huge trampolines that if you feel daring enough, you can careen over the edge and slam into one of those and hopefully get a little bit higher. I've done it a few times, and after quite a few controllers being thrown, I finally got the kind of hang of it, you know. you know, it's all about the eventual delivery time. So don't really worry about the clock. It kind of keeps track a little bit here and there and tells you, all right, this is how long this area is taking you or whatever. The other cool feature, as you mentioned as well, is the screening in the game. And so, I played this on stream, as I mentioned, and, which was really fun to do because I'm just randomly yelling profanities during the middle of the stream, which is kind of what I do anyway, but this time, you know, it was for a purpose. And that was to slow down the vehicle. It pretty much slows down space and time. Just in case you need like an extra second to kind of like correct your situation, there's a kind of a bounce, sideways dash that you can do, move, you know, and then being slow definitely helped with that too. Slow in the game, not slow mentally. But I know I often mistake those. But sorry, I was looking back through my notes. that was really cool. It ended up cutting out halfway through me playing the game. I played it a couple more times since, you know, I streamed it and beat it and stuff too, just to try to beat my time. But it is definitely a cool feature, you know, screaming and slowing down everything around you so you can kind of correct yourself or even just watch yourself fall into the insanity below in slow motion. That's always cool too. What else? The controls for the game take a little bit of getting used to. Joe, you played this one as well, didn't you? I got you a code.
It is very, very hard.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the name too. So how far did you get up there? Did you make it through the tutorial at least?
I did not. I can't control this thing worth a damn. It is like I haven't been able to play too much lately because of my arm.
That's right.
But I just like my brain can't mesh with the controls in this yet. I'm working on it.
Keep trying, man. It is one of those things that like I feel like these types of games fall into the same category as like Elden Ring, you know, or like a From Software game where you're fighting a boss over and over and over and over again, you know, and it's like you like, you know, you're going up the platform, just you get a little bit farther and then you fall off and you die. And then it starts you all the way back at the beginning. That would be my best description of this overall. And like you said, you had trouble with it. I had a little trouble with it at first. I started getting a little more control. I wish there was more button mapping for the game. I tried to switch things around a couple of times and it pretty much told me no. It was like, don't even try. And so I had to shut down the game one of the times to like get things to go back to normal even. That was my only real gripe with it. And then also, yeah, it's just a hard game overall. Once you get the controls though, it's pretty good. You'll kind of, as I mentioned before, kind of find yourself dashing off edges, hitting explosives, hitting a trampoline, dude, flying up in the dough. I did have troubles. I beat the game and then I played it again the same night and I probably got to the top in like half the time that I did before using all [S2] Wow. [S1] The shortcuts and things like that, which, yeah, I was blown away. But I got to the last section and I'm not going to try to give anything away, but it's the last section is nothing but like these speed ramps from hell, dude. You're like hitting one speed ramp and then you have to jump to the next one while going fast and then like jump to the next one. And I would get all the way to the last jump and then my car would like just it would decide to go backwards. It would like hit an edge funny and then like flip me around and then I'd just be like blasting back towards the way it came. I was like, no, dude. So there's a couple little things to it. I mean, the game is not like, you know, it's not a AAA title. It's designed well to screw with you, but not quite well enough for it to be like, okay, like this is perfect controls here, you know. But it is a troll game. It is a driving game. It's built around chaos. You know, I personally, I love these types of games. I love the challenge. I love the frustration. I love overall that goddamn rewarding feeling you get when you finally beat that boss. You know, you finally make it up to 100%. You're going to get mad at this game, but you're going to keep coming back to jump, dash, shortcut, you know, try to figure it out, you know. It is 100% as frustrating as it is fun, and I had a blast with this one for sure.
Ooh, well, it is $14.99. What is your verdict?
Go for it. Yeah, I mean, I would definitely. I thought about buying this game before, you know, I had contacted the company too, And I'm glad they gave me a code and gave us codes, you know, to play it too. It is really fun. If you're into that type of game, go into it knowing that you're going to get frustrated, but you're going to come back for more.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. We got one final game to talk about tonight. That is called K2 Digital Edition, developed by Devon Games, published by Akram Digital, released April 29th on Steam for $14.99. Easy to learn, hard to survive, popular board game digital adaptation, consulted with real K2 climbers. Choose the right cards for the right moment, rush to the summit before the weather breaks, or set up camps and prepare to push later. Play turn-based strategy with friends, AI, or in single-player mode. Purnell, what is K2 Digital Edition?
So, K2 Digital Edition is an adaptation of a popular board game that is apparently been around for a while, which I did not know until I heard about this, but it definitely made me interested and also made me realize that this came before games like Summit, which I was more familiar with in recent times. So I wanted to give this a go. And what I came away with was a pleasant surprise of a game that involves, you know, cautious movement and movement management. So, base concept of this game is that you control two hikers that are attempting to scale a large mountain. You might have expected me to say K2, but that is just one of many metals that are mountains that exist on this game. But for the sake of it, let's just say a mountain. You're scaling a mountain. Now, the way this works is that a mountain in this game is broken up into a series of, I guess, like points of interest where you can stop at. So think of them as nodes, being at the base level of the mountain and the top of the mountain. Each of those nodes are connected by pathways. And they are all also broken up into pretty much like four different sections of... Everything okay? I heard some like a sneeze or something.
No, I was just moving in my chair.
Oh, the edge of your seat, huh? I kid. The mountain is also broken up into four different sections. This comes into play when you factor in or evaluate the time of day or the time of, basically the day of the expedition. So in your hand, you'll have a series of cards. These cards on each turn are required that you select three of them before ending the turn. And these cards represent two things, typically. Either A, movement, number of spaces you can move with that particular card. Sometimes it's a single type of movement where it's just go two or three spaces. And other times, it might be more specific. Like, it might have a weird little arrow-looking thing pointing up and or down, which indicates that if you use that card to either ascend or descend, again, based on the depiction on the card, you get a different movement. So, for example, it might say up one, down three. Obviously, ascending up one, you can descend down three. Now, most of the nodes on the mountain come with a score. That is to say, if you get a hiker to reach that point on the mountain, you get points for that. So you want to traverse as much of the mountain as you can. Different areas of the mountain might require more than one, movement range to get there. Generally, it increases as you go higher up the mountain. Now, after you select the cards, you then take those cards and distribute the uses of them. Oh, sorry, there was one other type of card I didn't mention, which is oxygen. Oxygen is used to do exactly as it says, replenish the oxygen of your hikers. Now, once you've chosen the three cards and decide to go, you are then able to allocate those cards between your hikers. So, if you have a hiker who's not doing particularly well with oxygen, it might behoove you to drop some bits on that bad boy so they can breathe. Because you don't want nobody to die on this mamma jam. Now, at the end of a turn, the day will change. And when the day changes, depending on what the iconography is for it, that will have a number of effects. For example, eventually as you start going higher up the mountain, movement might actually drain your oxygen. As in, if you stop on a location, you might lose one of your oxygen marker items. If you run out of oxygen in this game, you die, or at least that hiker will die. So one of the effects of the weather might be that regions 3 and 4 out of the 4 regions will have extreme weather, which will make the penalty for stopping at those zones even greater. A spot that might have taken 1 oxygen to stay there now takes two or three or worse, i.e. you don't want to be in that area of the mountain on that day of the week because you think other people have had it bad. No, you don't know bad, baby. Now, there are a few ways that you can mitigate this issue. Sometimes, depending on the level you're on with the conditions that associate with the board, and otherwise not. The thing you can do at any given time is to set up a tent. A tent can be applied by spending the amount of resources associated with the number of movement that you it took to get to a spot. So let's say, for example, you want to put a tent down on a spot that requires one movement to get to. Well, you can just spend one resource from your movement pool to actually place a tent down on the ground. So that's not a bad way to go about it if you need to actually set something down to get yourself moving. And then that's what you'll do. And then once the tent is down, a player that stays in that tent will get one oxygen item back per day that they stay there. A lot of times you don't want to make this thing a console where you just kind of encroach in a tent indefinitely because time's ticking and you have a limited number of turns to get as high up the mountain as you possibly can. But if you find yourself in a situation where the weather just will not let up and the game does not want to give you the opportunity to make that special push to get to the top, you might find yourself building a tent and encroaching on a particular area or two of the mountain for a number of days before taking a crack at going upwards. Now, the other thing that can be done with that, depending on the game mode you're playing, is a snow cave. You can build snow caves in the side of the mountain to get oxygen back, but they have a turn limit of 2 days before they disappear, and you can't use that area as a snow cave anymore because it goes away. Cost remains, it's like two footsteps, I believe, or two energy to actually build a snow cave. Now, if you get to the top of the mountain to get the max points, it means nothing if your hiker dies. So you got to make sure that your hiker survives the day, the number of days in the game, which can be easier said than done sometimes, especially if you come out on a really bad end of the week or whatever, and it's just bad, 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 and you feel a little bit cocky, saying, if I just push hard enough, I can make it, and you might not. So be careful with that. There are a number of other little elements to this game, too, as far as like different, like, you know, traps or hazards, such as crevasses, where depending on, I guess it's not called crevasses, but basically like hidden locations. So you might go to a spot, and once you reveal what's there, it determines that either A, it costs more energy to cross it than you originally allocated to do it, or it might collapse entirely, forming a crevasse, and now you have to double back around to find a way around it, which of course costs you energy that you weren't banking on having to use. But that's the name of the game. And there's also like weakness points too, where depending on how you move your two hikers, you might have to allocate a particular token to one of the cards associated with them, which will make their movement go less than what they had available to them if they just had access to the card directly. The game itself is pretty fun. I do think it's interesting, however, that the real meat of the game usually starts to happen as you get further up the mountain, like the maybe 3 and 4 zones. So those first two, the first zone for sure, but sometimes the second section also, you almost like you're going through the motions just to get up to the part that where all the danger is happening. And I also be interested to see how this would play out if I was playing with other humans, because with other people, you'd have to worry about people sharing spaces with you, which they are not able to do. So you can block people from going up certain pathways and force them to go the long way around or whatever. So there's some actual agency of movement in beating someone to a primo spot before they can get there and block you out of it. I do think this game is a lot of fun. Like, I don't know, maybe some more fancy stuff would have probably made a weird difference for me, but then again, it would also change the game, because now I wouldn't have Hyper, that I'd have two fairies and a wizard climbing a mountain for no freaking reason that's different. But I like this game. I think it's a fun assessment to play, and it's not too long, and if you want to engage in some other elements, there's a campaign mode you can do where there's levels on it that come with conditions that the game wants you to fulfill, and there's medals associated with those conditions too, so it's almost like testing your medal and applying the skills you learn from playing single matches onto a grander scale. You're not required to do one type of board. The game has multiple boards in it as well, and they're not randomized. These are boards, I believe they're actually inspired or designed after the board game boards, but I could be wrong. I know the game had multiple expansions, but you can choose from any number of different boards in this game and play along that line, depending on what makes it, you know, easier routes, harder routes, and sometimes they'll have those additional conditions, like the ones I mentioned earlier. But Yeah, I think the game is a good time, and it's a lot of fun to play. It does come recommended by me. I'm not going to go buy the physical board game now because, I mean, this is doing plenty for me, and this isn't the game I think will benefit from having the physical over the video. So I'm perfectly fine with having it digitally. As for you, I feel as though digital may well be the way to go. This is worth your time to play.
Ooh, well, let's talk price. Actually, first, I'm looking at the Steam page, and it says it's the most popular board game about mountains. Are there other board games about mountains?
Absolutely. I own one upstairs right now called Summit. There's multiple games involving mountains. I don't know where the popularity comes from. It's probably Board Game Geek or something. I bet if you went to look it up on Board Game Geek, it probably has a numeric rating on their chair or their BGG ranking or something. But in which case, that line might be true. Summit might be far lower down the scale than K2 is. Also, K2 has a pedigree. It's been around for a while, so I'm not going to dismiss that claim.
I like when like games, you know, have a claim to fame like that or something. Like, you know, Big Nose Freaks Out is the most popular skateboarding game starring a caveman.
Are you going to disprove it? I dare you.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like board game about mountains does sound a little bit like a joke. But I mean, you know,
that's the funny part. Given the nature of these things, I would not put it past them to be right. Like someone could have totally went to the marketing pool and said, let's go to Board Game Geek. Let's see where K2 ranks. Let's look up. Are there any other mountain based games that are higher up the scale? Nope. Put it on the board. It sells. It's a selling point.
Sometimes games just be saying things. Like I remember I had a copy of The Last Ninja on the NES. It was, you know, originally that very popular Commodore 64 game, and they ported one of them to the NES. And the actual cartridge has a little banner on it that says number one game of the, or it was like game of the year. It was something like that. And I was like, yo, this came out in 1990, the same year as Super Mario Brothers 3. I think you're going to need to reassess that a little or maybe embellish a little on that. We need some clarifying statements here.
Kid and his brother that were trying to travel across the country to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to be in the
right
championship. It was there. It happened.
That would be amazing if the Wizard was actually about the Last Ninja.
The Last Ninja in the last tournament.
Yeah, yeah.
Gotta get there, kid.
Like Two Worlds 2 has a Game of the Year edition. Where?
Yeah, that's amazing.
Who ever called Two Worlds 2 a Game of the Year anywhere?
What do you happen to know what the year was?
I don't know. It's just,
I mean, there's no year in which
the Velvet edition. So
that's awesome.
2019.5.
Games just be saying stuff.
They do.
So anyway,
K2 is $15. We need a verdict.
It is an easy buy it recommendation from me, but don't take my word for it. Ask this used car salesman; he'll tell you the real deal.
And that's not all.
Poor Acolyte is now officially on my shit list.
Nice.
What do you do?
To sum it up, they have the best mountain game.
He's on my thumbs up list. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a couple points in my book, too. Well done.
I love horrible puns. They're the best. Up.
Excellent.
Oh, man.
Horror bowl.
Nailed it.
All right, well, that is it for this episode. We made it through. Big thanks to Adam for coming on, doing his thing earlier. Andy, thanks for coming on and hanging out with us.
Yeah, dude.
Pernell and Chris, thank you as always for being here, chilling the whole time.
Can't wait to honk shoe.
I don't know what that was.
You don't see sleeping. You don't seem sleep spelled out as honk shoe me. That's pretty good.
Do now.
That's the Three Stooges version.
Oh, I missed that. I haven't heard that sound effect in so long.
Yeah, I always liked it.
music box music playing.
Who's got some final? Actually, we'll give it to Andy. Andy, give us some final words to end the show.
Glorp, glorp. Glorp, glorp, motherfuckers. I have no words of advice for anyone. You're all a bunch of nerds for listening to us talk about video games, and we love it. Tune in next week. Here. I mean,
for another
Thursday.
Writing episode. Will Purnell get the proper amount of sleep? Will Chris drink more Red Bull? Will Sperry be on the episode? We'll find out. Let's do it.
Who knows? Next time on the SML podcast.